Holly Mendelberg is a political science professor at Princeton, and she's been working with Chris Karpowitz at BYU to explore how groups work together and how gender plays a part. They wrote a book a few years ago called The Silent Sex that explained, as you can tell by the title, how women in these mixed groups often get left out and don't speak up. Karpowitz told us a story about Mendelberg, something she noticed. Every year, she gets together with colleagues to talk about the business of her department, stuff like hiring and promotion. And usually, the women in these faculty meetings are outnumbered by the men, by a lot, usually. But one year, in one committee, it just so happened that it was all women in the group. And Mendelberg noticed things were different.
Because it's a committee of Princeton professors, these are all incredibly impressive women, and they all have very strong opinions. Tali is not shy, and neither were the other women on the committee. As they met together, my colleague Tali started to notice that the interactions were different. They gave each other additional time to talk. They affirmed one another's presence in the group. Even as they disagreed about specifics, they affirmed each other as important and valuable members of the group. They developed a kind of rapport, a norm of niceness, you might put it. They just validated each other in ways that were different from what she'd experienced in more male-dominated committees. I think this episode shows that the way we interact with each other really matters for building the authority and the influence of members of the group. So authority isn't just about what we bring to the group. It's also about what happens as we meet together. And what seemed to be happening in these groups is that women were helping each other to build authority as they made decisions together. And the real question is, how do you translate that sort of experience to mixed gender groups? How can we have interactions with each other? How can we develop dynamics as a group and norms of interacting with each other that build both men and women's authority and influence and allow everyone's perspective to be fully heard?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So just what was happening at that meeting? How did this group generate that sense of warmth and mutual respect? And why didn't the same kind of thing happen when men and women were together? That is what Karpowitz has been trying to figure out. And not only that, he wants to know, why is it that in mixed groups, the women don't participate as much? They get interrupted more. They're less likely to win an argument. So over the last few years, he and some colleagues at BYU have been conducting a field experiment about what happens when women are outnumbered in these group meetings. And it revealed a lot about the differences between men and women and the way they solve problems. So today in the program, we're talking about what they found in their research. The paper was written by Karpowitz along with professors Jessica Preece and Olga Stoddard at BYU. Preece and Karpowitz joined us for the conversation. And one of the first things I wondered was if Professor Preece, a woman who's been in her share of meetings with men, was at all surprised by any of the results in their experiment.
It's like asking a fish sometimes what right. water is like.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so I have had a number of experiences over the course of my life where I've sort of been like, hey, why aren't you listening to me? Right. And that's been frustrating. But I think one of the settings where it ends up being the most visible right, is in the workplace. And because in the workplace, you're in this mode of having to think about, you know, I have a career that I need to be paying attention to and directing, and I have interests and I have goals. And, you know, in other settings, sometimes you can be like, okay, well, that was weird, but whatever, right? Someone was having a bad day. But when you're in a work setting, the stakes are a little bit different. And so it can take dynamics that are that maybe even you're kind of used to, but put a special twist on them to make it an especially frustrating experience. Even when you can't really put your finger on what's going on, right? It just, you know, there's this an increased level of frustration that you're not being able to sort of pursue your goals and pursue your best interests in a way that that you like and that's important for your long-term career and well-being.
We'll get to the details of what you learned along the way here in a moment, but I wonder if as you were learning these particular things, all of it seemed pretty obvious to you and apparent to you.
I mean, when I do presentations on this to various audiences, the sort of informal subtitle of this presentation is, ladies, it's not just all in your head.
Right. Yeah.
And the number of times people have sort of come up afterwards and said, I just, you know, I've always just thought I was crazy, or I've just always thought, you know, I would try and say something, but people would be like, oh, well, that happens to everybody. Or, you know, I'm just so glad to have words to finally be able to describe the feeling that I have had. And so that kind of reaction has been extremely common where people have sort of had the types of experiences that we're talking about, but either they or someone else has kind of said, well, you know, I don't really think there's anything to that.
Let's talk about the experiment itself that you conceived of a few years ago. And the idea, as I understand it, was we're going to do this field experiment for several years. Now, you ended up only doing 2 years, and it's worth discussing why later, because that's an important part of the story. But explain the idea. As I understand it, you wanted to figure out how these workplace teams played out sort of in a real-world setting.
That's right. So Tali Mendelberg and I had done quite a bit of work in the lab where we brought groups together for kind of a one-time experience and decision-making together. And that evidence is really at the heart of our book, The Silent Sex, although we also looked at some school boards in real life. But Jessica and I wanted to explore what this meant for real groups that meet together repeatedly. And we wanted to see what happened in real life as we varied the gender composition of the group. And so we worked with an accounting program, a top 10 accounting program, and they were interested in this question to their credit. They wanted to know about the experiences that men and women were having in the groups that they form as part of their as part of the educational experience that their accounting students have. And so we worked closely with them to form different kinds of groups and to randomly assign men and women to either be in groups with very few women or in groups with a majority of women. And then we went back to these groups multiple times over the course of the semester. We brought them in a couple of times to watch them directly make some decisions together. And then we were able to look at what happened to men and women in those different conditions.
Dr. Preece, we should point out, because this seems important, that these were extremely accomplished women in an incredibly good accounting program. For the most part, they had better grades and more experience than the men in the program.
Yeah, I mean, their sort of resumes look, the men and women's resumes look very similar here, in part because it's an application-only program. And so, you know, when when you're filtering out people and admitting people based on credentials, then you end up with a set of very qualified individuals, and they're, you know, the men and women's GPAs look very similar. And you know, lots of them have previous like high school leadership experience. In fact, the women have more of the high school leadership experience than the men. So these are extremely talented and ambitious individuals who are, you know, choosing to apply to a rigorous top program. And so some of the concerns that people sometimes bring up of like, well, you know, maybe the women just aren't as qualified, or maybe, you know, they're just not as ambitious, or maybe, you know, any number of maybes. That is not really what's going on here. These are really talented, bright individuals who are well qualified to be there.
What were the assumptions? What was the hypothesis that you took into the experiment? You wanted to test. It sounds like you're just saying we generally wanted to test how these worked out. But were you also wondering, why is it that women don't seem to have the same kind of influence, the same kind of perception of authority that men do? Like, what were the working assumptions that you were going for?
So I have two answers to that question. The first is rooted in a bit of a story. So part of the impetus of doing this, or the genesis of the idea, is that I have a dear friend who was doing an MBA program. And I was talking with her, and she's incredibly talented and one of those people that's just like the leader in every room she walks into. Right. Extremely talented and has really, really great leadership skills. And she was talking to me about her experience in this MBA program, where they also assign students to work teams to sort of model the experiences that they're going to have. And she would say, I just don't know what's wrong with me. I just don't know. Like, I'm just feeling so frustrated. And as I you know, spoke with her over the course of her program, you know, in some ways that changed as she got more comfortable with her group members. But in some ways it really stuck around. And so, you know, as we were having these conversations, I thought, oh my goodness, I have a colleague, Chris Karpowitz, who has done like research on this, right? And so I thought, oh wow, here's a setting where, you know, where Chris's research is just like right there. But one of the things, and so I guess the initial hypothesis that we had was that these groups are likely to play out in similar ways to the groups that Chris and Tali looked at in the lab. But the question that we wanted to add to this study, and that we didn't have an answer to, and I don't think we didn't go in with a strong hypothesis, was what happens over time, right? Like, group dynamics are not static. Mm-hmm. They change. I mean, they're dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. And so they can change over time. And that's what we were really curious about, is as people get to know each other, as people recognize each other's talents, is it the case that some of the one-shot findings where women have trouble building authority, do they, you know, does that effect attenuate, or is it exacerbated over time? We don't know. And so that was a big question that we were really curious about, is how does this work in repeated interactions over long periods of time?
We're political scientists, so we're very interested in this question of authority. And by that, we mean the expectation of influence. When you go into a group, do other people in the group listen to what you have to say and sometimes follow what you have to say? Not every time necessarily, but how do the group members think about each other, and how does that shape what comes out of the group? And so we were very interested in this question of over time, what happens to authority when groups get to know each other really well and rely on each other, as many kinds of groups do. And so we thought that was a big difference from the typical lab study.
Chris Karpowitz, along with Jessica Preece, they're professors of political science at Brigham Young University, Together with Dr. Olga Stoddard, they're co-authors of a forthcoming paper called Gender, Authority, and Group Dynamics, a Field Experiment. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
For our 60th anniversary, KUER wants to know how you first became a listener to this station. We want to know about the driveway moment that turned you into a public radio listener for life. You'll be helping us celebrate our 60th birthday, and we might use your story on the air. To learn more, go to KUER.org or record your story at 801-581-KUER. Again, that number is 801-581-KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the findings of a field experiment by some professors at BYU. It's about how men and women interact and work things out in groups. And they found that not only are the women usually outnumbered, but they tend to stay quiet, that the men don't hear or pay attention to what they're saying if they do speak up. We have with us BYU professors Chris Karpowitz and Jessica Preece. So you'd think that familiarity might change some of these outcomes, that the more time these people spent together, the more women might come out of their shell or men might just be quiet and listen. But it turns out the amount of time these groups spent together didn't really make a difference to the outcome.
So in the earlier lab studies, what we found was that groups with very few women In groups with very few women, especially groups that decide by majority rule, women had trouble generating authority. They also talked less, and there are a variety of other elements of the group dynamic. When we look at these groups that meet over time, the finding is complex in the sense that when we actually observed the groups and had them do tasks for us, we again found this same deficit of authority in groups where women were surrounded by men. And the dynamic looked different in groups where women formed the majority of the group.
Yeah.
Now, there is some...
And that didn't change over time. At their specific interactions, the beginning... the period 4 months later, it was the same exact pattern.
Wait, okay, so there's, let's say that in one of these situations where you have a group where there's one woman, four men, let's say, in this group, because this was part of how it worked. It didn't matter over the course of several months how much those other men got to know her, how they were able to learn what she was interested in. It didn't matter. In the end, she still, because she was outnumbered, was less likely to get her way in these deliberations, was less likely to be influential, was less likely to speak out. That didn't change. That was fixed in some ways.
It was fixed in – so we took a variety of different measurements. And so when we were concretely observing their interactions, that did not change. And not only did it not matter that they had gotten to know her and her talents and skills, it didn't matter – how good she was at the task that they were doing, and it didn't matter how much she participated in the deliberations. The leaning in did not work. Now, before, you know, here's the wrinkle. Chris, do you want to explain the wrinkle?
There's a wrinkle.
The wrinkle is that those are the findings for discrete tasks when we brought the groups in and said, Let's have you make a decision together, and we watch them. That's the dynamic that occurred. When we asked them to make some sort of global assessments of just in general, as you think about your group over the past month, right? There, we do see some improvement for women over time. Lone women. They start out with a huge deficit, and things get a little bit better over time. It's very complex in the sense that that influence that they may build over time, again, doesn't seem to translate into specific tasks. So when we say, now tell us about this task that you as a group did together, again, the women face this authority deficit.
It's as if, you know, everything that they had sort of been building, it was just gone. It's like a blank slate when they came in and were having to do something concrete. And so, you know, I think as scholars, we're still trying to understand and figure out like what that means and how to understand the improvements that we see over the course of time and the sort of global assessments of who in your group is the most, who's been the most influential over the last month, right? We do see improvements there, but we don't see any improvements in the concrete, really precisely measured experiences that we can watch them do.
Yeah.
And the important thing to remember about that is that the dynamic looks really different in groups where women form the majority. Mm-hmm. And because of the way we designed the study, the women who are in the groups where they're the lone woman surrounded by men are on average exactly the same as the women in the majority women groups. So the difference is not that a certain type of woman was in the groups with a token female. The difference is the group itself.
The numbers matter.
Yeah,
exactly.
So
the
wait, okay,
matter,
okay.
The dynamics that the norms of interaction that the group builds matter.
Okay, so we'll get into some particulars here in a sec. But just so let's imagine then now a group of five, and you've got three women, two men, or four women, one man. What's different about that deliberation? What's different about those interactions?
A variety of things are likely to be different. And we might summarize those under the broad heading of the norms of interaction are different. So when women make up a majority of the group, one thing that happens is that the topics they talk about are different. So they raise a different set of priorities. And that pushes the group in a different direction. But it's also how they talk. It's not just what they say. It's also the norms of interruptions, for example, change. And especially the behavior of men toward women changes when women form a majority in the group. And so what happens in groups with more women is, on average, again, there are differences across groups, but on average, the group tends to develop a different type of discursive dynamic, one in which there is less negative interrupting, more affirming of each other, precisely the types of things that my colleague Tali Mendelberg noticed when she was in this decision-making group with her, of all women. She noticed that they were affirming of each other, that yes, they still had disagreements, but they were able to give each other space to talk in ways that were more helpful to women.
Well, and I think it'd be really helpful for listeners to hear, you know, what you mean. What are some examples, right? So Chris talks about negative interruptions, right? And those are interruptions where someone is talking and someone else interjects and says, "What? No. Or I don't think so. Or that's not right." And the point of those kinds of interruptions, as Chris and Tali talk about in their book, is to take the floor from someone or to sap their authority. And those kinds of interruptions are very different than positive interruptions, where someone's talking and the other person says, oh yeah. Now, like, technically that's an interruption. It's we call crosstalk, right? Where someone is talking and they're holding the floor and someone else starts speaking. But if the speaking that you're interjecting is, "Oh, such a good point," or, "Oh, I hadn't thought about that," you know, that doesn't try and take the floor away from somebody. It just affirms that what they are saying is interesting and worth paying attention to. And Chris and Tali find huge differences in the kinds of interruptions that happen in women-dominated groups versus men-dominated groups, specifically the way that men interrupt women.
Did the term mansplain come up in any of this? Like, it doesn't seem like a terribly useful clinical term, but it seems to apply. Did you see a lot of mansplaining in these group dynamics?
Yeah, I mean, that's one way of describing some of what happens, right? Because mansplaining is another way that men can sap the authority of women, right? Because what are you doing when you're mansplaining? You're really saying to the woman, the women in the room, I have to tell you what this is. You don't really understand the situation. And I'm going to explain it back to you, even though the women in the room may be the experts in whatever is being discussed. And so so I would classify mansplaining as another iteration of the kinds of dynamics that tend to sap women's authority.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, this is a really important point, because sometimes, you know, when someone says, ah, this person was mansplaining to me, or, and it can sound like a really petty complaint, right? I mean, there are things in this world that are much worse than being mansplained to, right? Yeah. But the root of the complaint is that this is sort of like yet another, sometimes subtle, sometimes overt way of just saying, you don't really have a whole lot to offer here, right? Or you don't have a lot of authority. You don't have the position to be able to be an expert in this scenario. And that hits at a deeper sort of root set of feelings and experiences. And that's why it's sort of, you know, even if it seems like a stupid example, it's representing a deeper dynamic that we show is real.
So the disadvantage that women have in these deliberative settings plays out in a number of ways that I wanted to ask you about. First, it plays out in how long they speak. Mm-hmm. Talk a little about that part, if you would, how long they actually speak up.
Well, when you're, I think it's tied to exactly what we've been talking about. So if you're in a group where the signals that you're getting include, well, when I try to speak up, somebody else speaks over me in a yeah. negative way, yeah. or they talk about other things, or they mansplain back to me, all of those things say, be quiet. We don't want to hear from you.
Why bother? Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like you keep telling me to lean in. And when I do, it's nothing but trouble. No one listens. And, you know, all of this takes effort. And why, you know, why bother if no one's going to listen to me, or it's people are just going to get, you know, jump all over me?
So one of the things we saw in the lab is in those types of groups, women participated dramatically less, it's not just that women's voices were less often heard because there were fewer women in the room. It was relative to their presence in the room. Mm. Women spoke much, much less than what we would have expected.
I think one finding that you had, and maybe this was earlier from the findings in the work that you did on the silent sex, was I think I read that their participation was only 2/3 of the average man's, right? Like they participated. Yeah.
Much less than what we would have expected. So for example, in a group of five, if speaking time were equally distributed, then everybody would take up about 20% of the conversation. And what we found in our lab groups was that women were taking up about half of that, maybe 10 to 12% of the conversation. Dramatically less than what we would have expected. Now, one of the things that's interesting about our accounting groups is that women there were leaning in. They were trying to speak and spoke up a little bit less than men, and a little bit less than what we would have expected, but nothing like the big deficit that we saw in the silent sex. And despite that, despite those efforts to lean in, they were still having trouble generating the authority. And we think that that's partly because of the other dynamics that are going on in the group.
It makes me, and I'm not sure this is an appropriate connection here, but it makes me think about the double bind. And I think that's the actual term for it. And this, let's say we're talking about female candidates. It seems like this is something that they're dealing with. When you show characteristics that are seen as traditionally female, like you show warmth or you show caring, you're dismissed. less competent, you're a pushover. But when you take on these traditionally male traits, like, you know, you're assertive, you speak up and speak out, you're not seen as likable. So you just can't win. Does this idea, this is, I think, referred to as the double bind, does that apply as well here?
Yeah. So, I mean, so there's been some conflicting research, right, on how the double bind is, which is exactly as you mentioned it. You can't win for losing.
Yeah.
you're either too passive or you're too aggressive. You can't, you know, there's this like tightrope that you maybe have to walk to be able to be seen as a leader, but also feminine enough that you don't set off anybody's, you know, bells and whistles. So there's some research that suggests for example, for politicians, that citizens sort of see politicians as its own like androgynous category or something that doesn't really matter. So Deb Brooks at Dartmouth has a series of experiments where she doesn't find a ton of evidence for the double bind. However, you know, she looks at it in a very particular way, and so we think this is probably part of what's going on. And I think the author I would point people to read about this is philosopher Kate Mann has written a book recently called Down Girl. And it talks about how the specific penalties that you get, that people are fine with you being a woman. It's not about, it's not necessarily about just like hating women. It's about hating specific behaviors when they are done by women, right? Behaviors that try and take authority or expect authority, and that sort of upset our sense of the proper role of women in a society, which is to sort of speak less and defer and things like that. And so while, you know, we don't have like conclusive evidence in our studies that that's what's going on, it seems quite probable, especially because we also asked group members to rate their peers on supportiveness, right? And what we do find is that the really talented women are rated higher with supportiveness, these lone women. So what we think is sort of happening is that people are catching that this person has some talents, but they're sort of pigeonholing it into this more sort of feminine idea of, well, you're just a really supportive group member. Right? You're not really influential. You're not really the leader. We don't really want you to be our spokesperson, but we acknowledge that you're very supportive. And that suggests that there are some gender norm things that are what are driving our results.
Okay, so I want to be careful with this next question. Because I know it's anecdotal and it may not necessarily be evidence-based, but you do hear a lot of, and you hear this from time to time, how would a woman leader handle this particular situation differently? And you're getting, for example, a lot of really laudatory terms about the way the New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, or Angela Merkel in Germany are handling the pandemic. And in ways it might be different. So I'm wondering what you may have learned in your field experiment that could inform that question of how do women deal with things differently? Because that is one of the things you have talked about, is it does seem to show that women pay more attention to those vulnerable people, for example. Families and children, I suppose that might make some sense, but they're likely to identify different things as problems even in the first place. So work me through that, if you would, both of you.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things to really keep in mind. The first is, you know, the countries that have elected women executives are different on a number of fronts, right? So we have a colleague, Joel Selway, who's shown that the specific kind of electoral rules that both Germany and New Zealand have, and a number of other places that have been quite successful, the elections function differently in those countries. So, you know, it might be that there are a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
So I want to, you know, whenever I see some of these articles, like the social scientist in me is like, whoa. Yeah. It's not just that they have a woman, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, you have to be careful about this, as you noted in the question. So I think that's important. But and the second thing that I would say is part, you know, my guess is that part of the reason we see different dynamics between men and women is because there are sort of social expectations that are related to power. And so when you are the most powerful person in the room, I don't know that it's necessarily the case that you're going to see the exact same pattern, right? Like how much of the women's difference in behavior is because sort of in a social way, they are lower, you know, in power, but in a board or in a setting where the woman is in charge, maybe that doesn't apply. So those are all of my caveats. So all the social scientists listening can
got it. So noted.
Covered my caveats there, right? But I do think that anecdotally, we sort of we hear that these kinds of the decisions can get made differently when women are in charge, and that might include creating a different set of norms. It might include having more women in the room. So when we're in charge and when we have the opportunity to put people in a room and choose who's in the room, we often just go to our reflexive, you know, who do we know? Who do we think would be good at that? And that's going to be shaped by our social networks, which are going to probably be highly gendered. And so perhaps one of the things that's happening in these countries is that the women know different people than the men would, and they're taking advice from a different or maybe a broader set of individuals. Maybe the way that they're running their meetings is a little bit different. And I think there's lots of room for political scientists to do research on what exactly is going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I endorse all of the caveats that Jessica said. And having said that, then I do think in group settings, women have the potential to bring a different set of priorities, a different set of perspectives and life experiences to bear. And how we structure the group so that those priorities and life experiences get heard matters a great deal. And again, we have control over those things. It's not just that we have to say, well, this is just the way it is. And as we get together, we can think systematically and carefully about constructing group group situations that allow those different perspectives, the perspectives of both men and women, to come out fully.
So one of the things you said, Dr. Preece, is that we have a lot of learning and unlearning to do. So let's talk about what could be done possibly to fix this, because one of the things you've mentioned, both of you, is that this kind of deliberation, you're going to have to design it differently. And it seems to me, I kind of wanted to start with the idea of let's do more as groups. Let's come to more unanimous decisions, like require unanimity, which is clunky and it's going to take a lot longer. That deliberation is going to not be so immediate, but it's going to be maybe in the end it'll be a lot better. Talk about that if you would.
Yeah. So every political scientist will tell you that decision rules matter a great deal and that unanimity, as you point out, Doug, does have some downsides, right? So it can take longer to get to a decision, and it can give everybody in the room a veto over the decision. But it also has the desire for consensus, the desire to seek for unanimity has some really positive elements. In the lab research that we were describing from the silent sex, we randomly assigned half the groups to decide by majority rule and half to decide by unanimity. And what we found is that in the unanimity groups, all of those authority deficits that we've been talking about in groups where women were outnumbered by men were at least dampened. So the unanimity helped women who were in situations where they were surrounded by men to develop more authority. And why is that? Well, unanimity rule sends the message that every voice matters, that you have to have everybody on board in order to make a decision. And so those subtle cues that what you say matters, that that your voice makes a difference, those matter for women, women's participation, and ultimately for women's authority. And unanimity is one way. It's not the only way, and it's a way that has some downsides, but it's one way to produce additional authority for women.
I liked this solution, or this one of the suggestions that you make. Practice positive interruptions.
Yeah, I mean, linguists have been telling us forever that the ways that we talk to each other and the verbal and nonverbal communication mean things, right? And so sometimes the right thing to do is to figure out, well, what are the signals in our culture? This is going to vary from culture to culture, right? But what are the signals in our culture to indicate when you're communicating with someone respect, right? And so one of those is something like positive interruptions. And just, you know, we do this, we'll nod when someone's talking. Referring back to things that people have said, where, you know, if someone has said something previously that maybe people weren't ready to listen to in the meeting or hadn't really caught on to it yet, Chris will say, you know, as so-and-so said earlier, or this relates to so-and-so's comment. And that is a way of acknowledging the participation of people and of acknowledging their contributions when there's some evidence that that acknowledgement is not distributed equally across people. And so a trick that there's been some research on is who you call on first in a meeting, right, or in some kind of setting. And there's some research that suggests that when you call on a woman first in a setting, if the first person to speak is a woman, then other women are more likely to speak up later in that conversation. Whereas if you call on a man first, women are much less likely to participate.
Here's one of my favorite things that could matter in changing the group dynamic. Listen for men. And it seems like you could put it this way. Dude, just shut up for a minute and let someone else say something. That seems like an important one, I think.
Yes, it is. In fact, and I think it's good advice, you know, instead of planning what your next comment will be, take time to really listen to what the other person is saying and to try to understand what the other person is saying. I mean, that it seems so elementary, but for guys, at least, you know, they need many guys. Again, there's diversity, but many sure. guys need to hear that it's good to be quiet and to listen and to model the kind of behavior that you'd like someone else to be having as you're speaking.
Dr. Priest, you have said that as a society that we have been slowly, this is how you put it, slowly socialized over the years to discount female ideas and points of view. So I wanted to ask you, how important is education when kids are, when they're young, giving them different models, giving them different, you know, ideas? How important is that?
Yeah, I mean, this is everywhere. These norms, gendered norms of interaction and who's speaking, it's everywhere. I mean, maybe you've seen the breakdown of speaking time in Disney movies, right? Like even in princess Disney movies, most of the time, most of the words are coming from men. And so it's not, you know, it's not just one place, but I think parents thinking very carefully about what kinds of models their kids are seeing, right? In parental interactions, in the media that they consume, all sorts of places. This will, it will just, you know, it's like it's slow drips. It's a trickle creating the Grand Canyon eventually over time, right? And you can't, right, like as a parent or a concerned adult, like you can't fix all of this yourself. These are problems that are much bigger than any one person can fix with their family. And so what that means is at the end of the day, you're just going to be doing a lot of pointing things out, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, did you notice that like the main character of The Little Mermaid, just like she didn't speak very much. We didn't hear very much from Ariel, did we? I wonder what Ariel would have said if she could talk right then or whatever, right? And so having the kinds of conversations, not all of the examples that are in your kids' lives have to be perfect, right? You can use them as opportunities to talk about the imperfections as well.
It seems like finally, there are a lot of really interesting kinds of conclusions, but the one that sort of comes out for me is something that you had said, Jessica Preece, that it's not women who are broken, it's society that's broken.
It's really tempting to be able to say, okay, well, you know, women don't talk as much, so just talk more, right? And that does a couple things. Number one, it puts the burden on the woman or the person who is experiencing all the effects of these negative things. It puts the burden on them to solve this problem. Mm. It's not a fair thing to do. Although it's our reaction lots of times with lots of problems in society. So that's the first problem. But the second problem is it works under it. The assumption baked into that is that if women behave the same way, you know, if they behave in a certain kind of way or they behave the same way that men behave, that they're going to get the same kind of reaction or the same returns to that behavior. And that is just one of the things that's really special about our research is that we show that's just not the case, right? You can't, you know, why can't a woman be more like a man? You know, Henry Higgins asks, right? Well, because if she does, she doesn't get the same reaction because we have social expectations that differ by men and women. And so what we have to stop thinking is that individual women can just behave the right way to fix this, right? If they just did this more, if they just did that more. And of course, you know, it's not to say that there aren't individual things that people can do. I mean, we don't, you know, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that we have to understand the context that people are operating in. And that context is a longstanding sort of cultural understanding of the way that women and men are supposed to interact. And that's not something that an individual can fix on their own through just the right behavior. And so we need to start thinking about how do we change those cultural expectations? How do we, in the spheres of influence that we have, right? How can we say, oh, you know what? I'm actually in charge of this meeting. So that means that I actually get to kind of decide how it's going to go. And I can, if I see things happening in a way that I don't like, I can just tell us that we're going to do it differently, right? Or I can call on somebody and say, I haven't heard from you. You know, did you have anything you wanted to add or any concerns about some of the things that we're talking about? So that's, you know, I think that's one of our take home messages is that this is just, it's bigger than individual human behavior. It's about systems and culture and expectations.
And just as Jessica said, you know, thinking about the elements of the groups we're a part of that we have control over and that we can collectively determine is likely to make a bigger difference than telling individual women to lean in a little more, right? Instead to think, well, how can we structure this group? Maybe it's thinking about the decision rule as we talked about. Maybe that means we're gonna have to have a little bit longer meetings than we otherwise would have. Maybe that means that we find other ways of signaling respect and authority and creating a group dynamic that really works. When we do that, We're likely to hear things that we otherwise wouldn't have heard. And the group is likely to make decisions that are at least somewhat different than they otherwise would have made.
Christopher Karpowitz and Jessica Preece, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
That's Chris Karpowitz, along with Jessica Preece. They're professors of political science at Brigham Young University and co-authors, along with Olga Stoddard, of the paper Gender Authority and Group Dynamics, a Field Experiment. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.